It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Muslims around the world have been struggling to carry out their traditional religious practices in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. But in some countries, the virus has also stirred up anti-Islamic sentiment. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The virus came just as Muslims were preparing for Ramadan, forcing them to celebrate at home rather than in traditional groups. Meanwhile, in New York, traditional Muslim burial practices have been disrupted because of the virus. And then there has been an outbreak of anti-Islamic violence in India. Take a look at the impact of COVID-19 on Muslims. We have on the phone with us Mukhtar Khan. He's an associate professor and founder of the Islamic Studies Program at the University of Delaware. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Don.
So let's begin with the impact that this virus has had in terms of the traditional rituals, particularly Ramadan, on Muslims.
See, the thing is that during the month of Ramadan, Muslims just rush to the mosque. They try to pray all the five prayers in the mosque. We have a special prayer after the breaking of the fast, after the night prayer, where we recite the entire Quran. We usually divide the Quran into 30 parts and recite one part on every night and read the entire Quran during the month. Some people even go early or in the middle of the night to pray in the Quran. So the Quran becomes the centerpiece of Muslim spiritual life. And because of COVID, all the mosques were shut and nobody was able to go there. And so I kind of described this as that our Ramadan was like a donut without a center for the first time. And so the mosque, which played a critical role in the spirituality and the ritual life of Muslims, essentially was sidelined. And so Muslims had to find new ways of performing their rituals and also in their spiritual practices. And actually, I'm amazed. I actually gave a small talk on this, as I was impressed and amazed at how quickly the Muslim community, nearly all over the world, adapted to the new circumstances using essentially technology, computers, and internet, and Zoom, and other such products, to essentially have a very fruitful and spiritually rewarding Ramadan. At least in the U.S., many of the scholars and spiritual leaders that I spoke to have said that they have had an exceptionally great Ramadan. And that was an interesting conclusion. There's a lot of socializing and partying in Ramadan, too, because people invite other Muslims to break fast with them, and so you're running from literally from mosque to somebody's house and then back to mosque. There's a lot of running around involved in some cultures. And all of that was like put to a halt, and Muslims stayed at home and used the extra time that they got to indulge in reading. It also inspired many people to up their charity. So a lot of Muslims gave far more charity this year than they would normally.
When you indicated that some of the scholars that you talked to said that they actually had a fairly good Ramadan, what did they mean by that? What kind of characteristics did they feel they had?
Well, let me give you a few examples. So, for example, Fridays, we usually have four or sometimes five Fridays in the month of Ramadan. Very rarely five. I don't remember ever having five. So what happens with these Fridays is that we have a Friday sermon and people come and have congregational prayers. And because we could not organize these congregational prayers, we did virtual sermons. So for example, I did a virtual sermon for a community in Lancaster, which is about 60 miles from here. In fact, the coming Friday, I will be doing another sermon for them virtually, sitting in my study. I will give the sermon recorded, and it will be premiered on YouTube, and people after prayer will, people before their prayer will listen to the sermon on YouTube and then pray. So, but what it also did was, some people who thought that maybe this does not amount to a proper sermon decided not to call it a sermon and called it Friday Reflections. The moment they took the category of sermon away from it, they suddenly realized that if this is a Friday reflection, then we can open it. And so suddenly a large number of women were giving Friday reflections through Zoom and on Facebook Live. And so for the first time, I think that Muslim women took a much, much bigger role than normal in the spiritual and religious life of the Muslim community. There were many, what do you call, Zoom-based study circles that emerged, and also more women engaged in this and participated in it. So from the gender perspective, you could say that this was something that took the community forward. And the good thing is that now that they have adapted to the innovative practices, I think the community is not going to step back to where it was a year ago. And so in that sense, there has been something incredibly beautiful. Even the Eid, the celebration, the festival after Ramadan, was mostly virtual. And so we gave virtual sermons and we had virtual celebrations on it. I did something very unusual this Ramadan. I launched a series of conversations. I call them conversations with my last name. And I spoke to people who are contemporary translators or commentators of the Quran. One is from the Middle East and from overseas. And we studied the Quran and I conducted discussions with them. And a lot of people have watched this issue. So in that sense, I think that intellectually, spiritually, from a knowledge-based perspective, this was an exceptional Ramadan. But from a social perspective, it was obviously deficient. I remember hugging nearly everybody that I would meet on the day of Eid. I only hugged my family, immediate family. So yes, from a social perspective, reconnecting with people who perhaps you don't see for months and then see them in month of Ramadan, that was missing. But virtually, we connected with more. Some of these seminars, we had people from other parts of the Muslim world joining in. So in that sense, we had a more global Ramadan, but a less physical, engaging, reconnecting with the community. There's something else that I would also like to share, that because the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, lived during the period of during his lifetime, there was a plague. And so we have teachings from our Prophet on how to deal with plague. So, for example, there is a very famous tradition from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in which he says that when you hear that there is a plague in a land, do not go to it. And if you are in a land where there is a plague, do not leave that land. So essentially, shelter in place is how I understood that tradition. Don't go where there is a plague, and if you are in a place where there is a plague, do not leave there. Basically, do not spread it, do not cause contagion. So that tradition became very important, and nearly every scholar was talking about it in their sermons. But there's also something interesting, and this started first in Bahrain, during a certain environmental issue, I think there was some kind of the storm brewing that during the Prophet's life, that the call for prayers was slightly changed. So the call for prayer says, please come to successful life, please come to the mosque to pray. They changed the last line and said, pray at home. This was during the time of Prophet's life. So that call for prayer also became very popular globally. And suddenly Muslims said, what? The Prophet said pray at home because there is some trouble outside. And so people went and rediscovered some of the sources which had remained dormant. And so it became much more easier for Muslims to preach shelter in place and stuff like that.
Just briefly explain to listeners the significance of Ramadan.
Ramadan is, there are five pillars of Islam which are well known. One of the pillars of Islam is to fast from dawn to dusk in the month of Ramadan. So Muslims fast for a whole month. For example, in Delaware, we were fasting from around 4:30 in the morning till about 8:45 in the evening. We don't drink, we don't eat anything, no food, no sexual activity, No fighting, no getting angry, no getting upset. So there is both a physical fast, and there is also a spiritual fast. We also try to recite the Quran as much as we can, pray as much as we can, meditate on God as much as we can. So the idea is like a spiritual boot camp, intensive boot camp for 1 month, where we are encouraged to give more and more in charity. And the hope is that the habits that you develop in the month of Ramadan to avoid committing crimes and sins and doing good things, so avoiding doing bad things and doing more good things in the month of Ramadan, that momentum hopefully will keep us doing good things for the next 11 months before the next boot camps come.
I want to turn to something that I read about, which was in New York, and which we saw, of course, a large number of deaths. And one of the things I read was that the burial ritual that is done for Muslims got interrupted. Tell me a little bit about that and what you know about how the community dealt with that situation.
So the way Muslims deal with their funerals is we try to bury a person as quickly as possible. So sometimes on the same day. So there are examples. To give you an example, my father died at 1 a.m. at night, and by the afternoon prayer, so in less than 11 hours, he was buried. And and one of the things that we do is there is a ritual washing of the body, and usually it is done by family and friends. It's a very systematic cleaning of the body, and then you wrap it up in a shroud, and then you bury the body. But apparently this time in places like New York and New Jersey, where there were many Muslim deaths. In fact, New York Times had an article saying there were Islamic centers which were having more than 15 funerals per week, so nearly two a day. So what they were done is that apparently the bodies that were given to them were in sealed bags, so they could not even wash the bodies. So the imams then issued fatwas or edicts saying that just pray and pour some water over that part and then bury it. So to families, etc., it was truly traumatic, you know, burying bodies without the ritual bath. I remember washing my father's body, and I was constantly crying, but I also kept thinking of my brother who was in the States at that time who couldn't come for it, and I kept thanking God that I was there to perform the final rites of my father. So, you know, so these are very emotional moments, and people have not been able to attend funerals. Some places only two people are allowed, one imam and one member of the family. So the rest of the people are not even able to participate in the ritual rites of the funeral. So, yes, it has been very traumatic. And usually, you know, the COVID doesn't strike once. It strikes multiple times in families. Usually other members of the family also get it. So there are families, Muslim families, especially in New Jersey and New York, which have had more than one death in their family. And so they had to suffer through this. It has been very painful. And I don't know whether your audience realizes that, but the Muslim community, especially the immigrant side of the community, has a disproportionately large number of doctors and health professionals. The medical professional is highly valued, especially in South Asian societies. And, you know, I say jokingly that everybody from South Asia is born pre-med. You know? So they're born pre-med, then they choose to be a doctor or not. So we have tons and tons of doctors and nurses and others in the community. And they've all been on the front lines, and there have been several infections and several deaths. Young Muslim doctors have died. I read a story about a Muslim family in New York where the father and all three daughters are nurses, and all four of them were fighting COVID in the same hospital. So my heart went out to their mother and wife. You know, she has all four members of her family on the front line. So in that sense, also, it has been very challenging, the experience, and it still is.
I also understand, particularly in New York, that taxi cab drivers, restaurant staff, constructions, that end of the economic scale, there are also a lot of Muslims who participate. And obviously, if you're out in the public and you have to interact, that also, I would expect, have an impact on the number of people who might contract the disease.
Yes, and also these professions have not been able to, you know, actually earn their living normally. So there is a segment of the Muslim community, especially in bigger areas, which have been hurt. There is my favorite Indian restaurant on Main Street here in Newark, and I thought I would order some food from there, and I found out that his restaurant has been closed for a month, and my heart really went out, and, you know, and so he thought I really needed food, and so he said, if you give me a few hours, we will prepare at home and bring you food. I said, no, that's not what I was looking to. I was just trying to patronize the restaurant to help it around, and I found that all the employees, etc., were now jobless because the restaurant had shut down. And I mean, this is common to everybody. All small businesses in the country have been hurt tremendously as a result of this. Some have lost businesses forever, which may never recover, and others have hopefully managed to cope. So while we don't have a proper way of assessing the economic damage the community has suffered, I think that while we may have suffered economically, there has been a tremendous spiritual growth in the community all over the world as a result of this. In some places, yes, like India, Muslims have been kind of demonized because of a couple of, shall we say, unwise decisions made by some Muslim groups. But otherwise, more or less, Muslims have really risen to the challenge of the COVID Ramadan.
I wanted, by the way, to turn to India because as I was reading that there is a rising antipathy, I guess, towards Muslims in the press. There's also some Muslim businesses have been boycotted. At one point, I think I read where some Muslim volunteers were helping out, trying to ration out help to others, were described as coronavirus terrorists. What's going on with that?
Last few years, actually, there has been significant oppression of religious minorities in India because of the rise of the Hindu nationalist movements. And this is not something new. This is so old that when Obama was president, he spoke about it very specifically, that I wish that Gandhian values would influence the way Indian government was dealing with its Muslim minorities. So you can find those quotations by President Obama when he was president and even afterwards. So what happened was there is a Muslim community group called Tablighi Jamaat, which had a conference around the 20th of March, and they had some foreigners come in from Indonesia and Malaysia who were COVID positive at that time. And so this rumor spread that Muslims are deliberately spreading it, even though, you know, some of the policies of the government led to literally millions of displaced workers. People from large cities traveled thousands of miles in large processions. There were Hindu and other religious events which were also not, maintaining social distancing or wearing masks, etc. All of this in late March. So, but as a result of that, as things began to get worse, the vernacular media and some of the Hindu nationalists started blaming Muslims as spreaders of COVID, etc. Now they have, of course, switched to attacking China. But it is so bad that as of today, yesterday there was an article published in, I think, Pennsylvania Daily, where a university professor of Penn, UPenn professor, Professor Saswati Sarkar, she actually has been tweeting saying that Islam's contribution, COVID-19 is Islam's contribution to India. And she has also said that every person who has died or who has acquired this is somehow Muslims are responsible. So these demonization of Islam and Muslims also open up, especially in India, and that has led to Muslim vendors, etc., unable to sell their goods in Hindu neighborhoods, and 80% or more of India is Hindu. So Muslims in India have suffered a little bit, but that group which had made that mistake of hosting that conference, and, you know, religious groups all across the world have shown less respect and less regard for social distancing, etc. Even churches in the United States have been going crazy. Look at Donald Trump's the event that he hosted in Tulsa, there was no social distancing in the stadium. But they were just focusing on Muslims of India as saying they're spreading it. And that has led to violence and discrimination that has increased. And now that hatred is coming to us, to the U.S. also, with professors in respectable universities trying to blame Islam. I mean, Islam is a religion. I don't know how Islam spreads COVID, even though there are Islamic teachings specifically which advocate social distancing, etc. So there's an ugly side to it. It was targeting Muslims first in India. Now it's targeting China. And because of the geopolitical tensions between India and China now, so people are using this. Our own president has used the word Kung Flu to refer to COVID-19, which a lot of people think is a racist slur. And Asian Americans are feeling very frightened here in the U.S. as a result of some of the racist ways in which the virus is being talked about. So, yes, there is a dark side to it. People all over the world, in all communities, in all religions, have really come forward to not only face the challenge of COVID-19, but to help each other. I mean, if you look at the medical profession, I talked to a psychiatrist about this, and she tried to point out to me that one of the things that we are not talking about is the mental health of the medical professionals, as well as the burnout of medical professionals who are working, you know, like hours and hours and dealing with the COVID patients and the challenges that the pandemic has posed to the medical system. So, yes, by and large, the human race has risen up and showed the best side of it. But unfortunately, there are some of us who want to show the other side, too.
I want to finally turn to something that you touched on a moment ago, which is the religious traditions and how they deal with the plague. You indicated with Muhammad, he certainly had what appears to be some recommendations. Tell me a little bit about those traditions. Is it the Jewish tradition, Christians, and obviously Hindu traditions?
Well, I did a series of discussions with religious leaders from various communities about what their faith teaches. So it was interesting to me, the person who spoke from the Hindu tradition was not a trained pastor or pundit, but he talked about how certain aspects of Hindu lifestyle, such as cleanliness and vegetarianism, is something that would, in the long term, if adapted widely, would continue to protect people from pandemics of this sort. So that was an interesting point from his perspective. So the Abrahamic tradition, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism all have explicit texts that deal with pandemics. So because of the story of Moses and the Pharaoh, where God visited Egyptians with all kinds of plagues, I think it's 5 plagues or 8 plagues in the Bible. So there are texts which talk about pandemics. Now, there can be a positive way of looking at it, and there's a negative way of it, where you will then attribute these pandemics as something as God's vengeance or God's punishment against people. So some religious people came out and made hateful comments such as, oh, this is a punishment for homosexuality, or this is a punishment for certain deviancies in the societies that they see, which are neither confirmed nor denied by God. But nevertheless, it does create an ugly moment in society. However, the fact that there are religious teachings does enable this. So, for example, I gave you already examples of the Prophet Muhammad's teachings about how to deal with plague, which came in very handy for Muslims to adapt. But also with Christianity, during the Roman Empire, when there were the plagues attacking southern Europe, the only people who went around helping those who were infected by plague were Christian monks. And then suddenly the population was awakened to this new religion and this faith where love and service was so important. And as a result of the service that Christian monks provided to many Europeans infected by plague, Christianity began to spread very fast in Europe. So in many ways, the Abrahamic tradition has some kind of connection to plagues and has teachings which then becomes important to talk about it. I talked to a rabbi, Rabbi Michael Beans here in Delaware, and he told me as to how during Passover they normally do talk about plagues that were visited upon Egyptians. And so this time, you know, there were more poignancy and more seriousness with which those stories were narrated and listened to.
So as you look ahead, do you think that this this plague or this pandemic is going to permanently change some of the rituals, some of the ways that Muslims connect with one another, as you indicated earlier?
It has opened doors to new practices, definitely, you know, new practices, definitely. We have suddenly realized that so many things can be done virtually. I am curious to see how it evolves going forward. And it also is going to give opportunities, I think, for women particularly to play a greater role in the spiritual life of Muslims. It has also expanded the spiritual, it has expanded the discourse. For example, there are only 7 or 8 mosques in Delaware, or 9 mosques, depending on how you count them. So on any given Friday, only 9 people can give sermons, or if you have 2 congregations, only 18 people can give sermons. But now that people are talking about spiritual things, and they have got used to using technology and internet and Facebook Live and YouTube, etc., you will find that a lot and lots of people who would otherwise not be engaged in preaching will be sharing their religious ideas and religious thoughts on social media. Already social media had become a big, shall we say, purveyor or spreader or distributor of religious ideas. There are superstars on YouTube with millions of followers from all over the world preaching already. But this has, I think, given greater impetus and greater legitimacy to performing rituals using social media. In the past, there were only lectures and talks. Perhaps we might see more rituals being performed through this. It also had a very connecting moment. Like, for example, lots of my friends and relatives who live abroad, who I had never met, they celebrated their Eid this year by listening to me give a virtual Eid sermon, you know, and they would otherwise never ever get to see me give a sermon. I mean, they can see the videos of it, but not be participant of it, but this time they were. So that is also another beautiful aspect of it. Where does it go further? That it will only depend. But the good thing that came out of it is that this is really very important, is that Muslims all over showed a progressive proclivity, which to me is fantastic. They did not, you know, sit back and say, oh, this is not how the Prophet is, oh, this is innovative, this is not permissible in our faith, and so on and so forth. We didn't see much of that. We saw that in the beginning, especially before even Ramadan started. With Friday sermons, people were reluctant to shut it down and reluctant. Some of it is financially motivated because, you know, people, when they come to the mosques, they give donations, and if they're not coming, the donation will definitely drop. So there is a financial side to it, which will become apparent after some time. But otherwise, the spirituality has definitely expanded. And I see now some of the scholars who were giving lectures, etc., are now continuing to give lectures and spiritual talks using Zoom and Facebook Live and YouTube, which they were not doing 3 months ago. And people have now also got in the habit of watching. So that is a good thing, I think.
Well, we've been speaking with Mukhtar Khan. He's an associate professor and founder of the Islamic Studies Program at the University of Delaware. Appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Don, for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Today, the dry, sandy soil along the river takes its toll on oxen. Teams are tired and sweaty. Wheels sink 8 or 10 inches with each turn as teams slog up the river's edge, 16 miles since sunup. Breen resorts to the whip for the first time. At the junction of the North Platte and Beaver Creek in the high prairie, 5 days west of Fort Laramie, the wagon train lumbers south to lay over a day. It's the day before Independence Day, a good enough day as any to take time off trail driving. Ashley Sweeney in her novel, Answer Creek. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. The great Missouri-based trails, the Oregon, Mormon, and California, used in the westward expansion between 1829 and 1870, saw approximately 500,000 immigrants making the journey to the west beyond the Great Plains. Most of these pioneers have been forgotten today, except for perhaps one, the Donner Party. And the 87 members of this party would probably have been forgotten as well, except for the ordeal near Truckee Lake and Alder Creek in the High Sierras, and perhaps also because of the stories of cannibalism. My guest today is Ashley Sweeney, here to talk about her new book, Answer Creek. Ashley, welcome to Delmarva Today.
Thank you so much for having me, Hal.
Ashley is the winner of the 2017 Nancy Pearl Book Award for her first novel, Eliza Waite. Answer Creek is her second novel. It is a historical novel. Ashley currently lives in the Pacific Northwest and in Tucson. But I want to add here, if you will excuse me, that her father is Jerry Sweeney, a familiar writer here on the Eastern Shore. He is one of the editors of the Delmarva Review, as well as a past president of the Eastern Shore Writers Association. Ashley, briefly give us the context of this journey that you depict in your book.
Yes, well, let's consider 1846 in the United States, Hal. The Oregon Trail had opened up in 1843, so it was early on for the westward expansion. The U.S. had a new president, James Polk, and he was wedded to the idea of manifest destiny, that the westward expansion was providential and a given right to all Americans. So if we think about that mindset, there became a frenzy of westering fever, they called it. And people of ordinary means would stop what they were doing, pack up a wagon, and join a train going west. It was a time of adventure and opportunity with a wide open prairies ahead of them.
Well, in terms of your book, why did you choose to write about the Donner Party. There have been a number of books, articles, and films about the Donner Party. Why did of the 500,000 that made this trip from Missouri, why did you choose the Donner Party?
It was a challenge, Hal. I figured if I was going to be writing a Western story, I might as well take on the most iconic story of all, which is the Donner Party. And in that was the gravitas of bringing a new perspective to this journey. And that's why I am firm in my belief that the novel captures the humanity of the immigrants. It isn't a salacious story. It isn't a sensationalized story. It's about real people who did what they needed to do to survive. Now, I know that there's been, at last count, I think 343 books written about the Donner Party. So this would make 344. But there hasn't been a novel about the Donner Party recently, except for one paranormal novel that came out 2 years ago. So I felt like it was time for a fresh retelling of this story. And of course, at the time I was writing, and even at the time before the book was just published, I had no idea that we would be in the middle of a pandemic and sheltering in place. So this novel is really resonating with a lot of readers because the Donner Party was sheltered in place for 124 days in windowless huts at the edge of the eastern slopes of the Sierra Nevada mountains. And it really puts it into perspective about what our sheltering in place looks like when they had to subsist on book covers and shoe leather and tinged ends of hides, let alone when they resorted at the last moment to cannibalism.
What are your readers telling you? How are they relating their situation to what they're reading about in Answer Creek?
Well, I'm basically hearing that it puts it into perspective, but it's still a hard story to read. And even the best of reviewers have said they've had to put the novel down several times to really contemplate what that would have been like. I'm telling it in present tense, so the reader feels like they are there on the journey with Ada Weeks. And I might mention that Ada Weeks, the protagonist of Answer Creek, is the only fictional character on the Donner Party rolls.
Tell us a little bit about Ada Weeks and why you chose this wonderful woman. And before you do, however, let me add my voice to those of your other readers. I thoroughly agree with them. You have such a power of description and a power of narrative in this book that one is exhausted along with these pioneers. As we read, we begin to feel the grit and the dirt and the smell and the difficulty. And this is before they ever got to Truckee Lake and began their difficulties. It was just, what you have given us is just an amazing experience of what it must have been like. on a normal day in this caravan of immigrants. Now, your character is Ada Weeks, and she I found to be a very, very interesting fictional character in the midst of this historical happening. Tell us a bit about Ada, how you came up with her, what you expected of her as you wrote, and how she captured you and took on a life of her own.
That's a great question. When I was first drawn to the party, I thought I really need to have a strong female protagonist. She had to have enough agency to speak her own voice, but she also had to be a daughter or a wife or a sister or a servant of someone else traveling. We have to take into consideration the role of women in the mid-19th century, and that was basically as a silent partner to the men on the journey. So I tried to conjure a character, and I was reminded of a junior high school friend of mine named Anne Thomas, and she became my muse for Ada. I contacted Anne. She lives in Chalfont, California, near Bishop, also in the Sierras. I visited her. We had long talks about it, and she became the model for my character, so that while I was writing, I could picture Anne, her stature, her demeanor, her outlook on life. She's a tough woman. And I thought, I'm going to take Anne's character and then imbue her with the thoughts and the values and the mores of the mid-19th century. There were many times, Hal, when I would call or email or text Anne to say, what would you do in this situation? So she really became my silent partner in writing the character. So Ada Weeks is 19. She's orphaned twice, first by her birth parents and then by her adoptive parents on the trail. And she joins the Patrick and Margaret Breen family as a type of a housekeeper slash nanny as the Breens are traveling west with their 7 children. So she's a very interesting character. She's not like any character I've ever read, and she certainly is not me, because I faced a very hard reality in the writing of this book, Hal, and that is that I would not have been tough enough to survive this journey. And if mortality doesn't strike you in the face every day, it certainly struck me in the writing of this book.
What was the role of women? You touched on that as kind of helpmates to the men who did the heavy work. But beyond that, what was the role of the women on this wagon train?
Well, they were cooking 3 meals a day, washing their clothes in the rivers, darning socks at night, rearing children, trying to educate them along the trail, whether that was by book learning or nature learning or a combination of the both. Then also taking care of men's needs, everything that a man would need along the trail. So they were hard working and often haggard. Think about giving birth on the trail or aging on the trail. It wasn't as if they were sitting in comfortable homes back in Illinois or Indiana or Missouri. They were full helpmates on the trail with a lot of responsibility and no voice. Now that's where Ada comes in, because I feel a great weight on my shoulders, Hal, to tell untold women's stories. And even though Ada is fictional and she's based on a friend of mine, she's really a composite of hundreds of thousands of pioneer women who traveled west. So when I was mining diaries and journals of women who traveled on the trail, I would take snippets from one journal and snippets from another diary, and I would help to conjure Ada's character about what was expected of her. And mostly what was expected of women at that time was to be silent.
I got, and you can tell me if I have not understood this well, but one of the subtleties I found in Ada Weeks was her fierce sense of independence and knowledge of her feminine worth, and at the same time, her ability to withhold this expression in many ways. So you have created in her a real tension between her independence, desire for independence, and her independent action. She does act independently, but in terms of taking a leadership role and advancing opinion, she is very reticent.
Yes, she does talk to the other women on the train, and there is internal dialogue also in the story. And she's not one to say, "I told you so," when tragedy strikes. She's stoic, she accepts her lot, but she also is moving on toward the goal of making it to California at all costs. She's not going back to Noblesville, Indiana. She's an orphan. She doesn't have a husband or a brother or an uncle or even a son to care for her. So she realizes deep within herself that it's up to her to make it there. And I think that's that piece of grit about Ada that causes her to succeed. Now, you had mentioned earlier about the number of people on the trail, and in the Donner Party itself, of course, the numbers, some say anywhere between 86 and 91 people are considered to be part of that journey for different reasons. Some people left, two were Native American, one was Mexican. So there were different variations of how many people actually were in the Donner Party. But the interesting part is half of them perished and half of them survived. And many people have asked, what is it that caused those to perish, and those to survive. And that's a very interesting question, because it's not just about the majority of the women survived because of body fat. That could be part of the scientific reason. But there was a psychological reason, and most of the women survived, in my opinion, because they had a strong sense of getting to where they needed to go and protecting those in their care. And those included many, many children. And many of the children did survive.
It was interesting in my reading about the Donner Party in preparation for our discussion that, 48, the sense was that 48 people survived. And the majority of those, interestingly enough, were women, were children who were like over a certain age, and interestingly enough, men who traveled in families, that the bachelors fared the worst. Do you have a sense from your reading and your research why that might be?
That was one of the most surprising elements of my 2 years of research. Here you have a cadre of young, strong, ambitious bachelors who are hired on as teamsters or drovers, and they have everything that you would need physically to survive. So my perspective is that once they ran up against the blizzard, and I might add that the Donner Party missed the window of opportunity to cross the Sierra Nevadas by only one day. They had left Independence, Missouri in mid-May, and they were running late on the trail. That's a whole nother story. So it's mid-October, late October, and they get to the eastern slope of the Sierra Nevadas, and they are marooned for what turns out to be the rest of the winter. And I feel like those bachelors gave up. They basically resigned themselves to the fact that they were not going to survive this. And it was one of the most surprising, as I say, elements of all of my research, and quite an interesting story.
Well, let me ask you to tell us a little bit about the sensational part of this story and what happened in the Sierra, in that pass, near the lake. And why it seems to me that they also had bad luck, because this was kind of a freak snowstorm that pinned them. So tell us a little bit about what happened to them, and are the cannibal stories accurate?
Well, from my research, the blizzard that stranded them in late October, by the time they had really, they were disoriented already, they were starving already, they were weak already. By the time they woke up from this blizzard, their cache of cattle meat was buried under 12 feet of snow, and they had no tools left to dig through the snow to get to it. Many, many people have questioned, why didn't they just find that cache that they had under there? But they couldn't. The fact is, they could never find it. So they began to boil the bones of the cattle that they had eaten the meat of. They began to boil the hides. They began to singe the hides and eat the skin. Then they were just having a watery gruel of a tiny bit of flour that they had left with water. And by the time the winter wore on is when they were eating their clothing and their blankets and their books. They were chewing on bark from the inside of their cabins. And the stories about cannibalism were definitely a last resort. The emigrants did not turn to cannibalism until the very end. And with one exception, no one was killed, Hal, for their flesh. This was dining off of the already deceased. In only one situation that's still controversial today, about the last man left at the lake named Louis Kiesberg, it's speculated that he might have murdered the last two toddlers before he was rescued. But he denied it his whole life. Many people never talked about it again throughout their lives, or the children later in their lives would write out, you know, their stories. But let's think of 19th century journalism too. I'm a former journalist, and sensationalism was what got everybody's attention. And so many, many, many of the stories about cannibalism were highly fictionalized.
How were the survivors received when they got to civilization and cannibal stories began to circulate?
The Donner Party was stigmatized and they were marginalized, and it took many years for instance, the Reed family and the Breen family escaped the horrors intact as a family. And they went on to have successful lives in the San Francisco, California area. But at first, which is where the book ends, Ada is still, she has survivor guilt. And she retreats to the woods off of Answer Creek, and we can look into that name of Answer Creek on a lot of different levels. But it became the place where I could round out her character arc, I could give resolution to the story, and I could end with how the experience speaks through the ages to people who are still alive today. How much do we really listen to what our ancestors are teaching us and telling us? And that brought me to a wonderful discussion with my father, by the way. And he had recently told me that his grandmother, who he loved dearly, had been a chuck wagon cook in Colorado in 1900, and the bells started going off in my head, and I thought, I think there's another novel there.
Well, it sounds to me like there is, and it sounds, if you wanted it, you might have a very good partner to help you with the research, because of Jerry's fictionalized family history that he has written.
I am halfway through my third novel, though, which is set in 1905 rural Arizona. So that one will come to completion before I start on any new project.
Is that a historical novel as well?
Oh, yes. They'll all be historical novels set in the West with strong female protagonists.
Well, Ashley, I hate to say that we're out of time. A half hour goes so fast when there is so much good material to talk about. And your book is certainly that. I have to say, I really loved it. And I highly recommend it to our audience. Ashley, let me say that your descriptive powers are amazing, and you more than capture, as I said earlier, the grit, grime, and hardship of this journey, but also the terrible mindset of people who are starving. You capture that as well. The Donner Party offers, I think, a challenge to all of us. Thank you for your book and for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to all of you for joining us as well. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.